The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, JV Johnson. Thanks for joining me. I hope everybody is safe, healthy, and if you have an issue going on with what we've been dealing with, which I don't even want to say the name, I hope you're taking the proper and appropriate steps to get the treatment and help you need. Also, I hope you're monitoring and taking very, very seriously this social distancing and the self-quarantine stuff. It's really kind of important. We're seeing the spread of this pandemic in a lot of cases because people are ignoring it or taking it lightly. So I hope you're not. I hope you're being smart, protecting your family and your loved ones, and doing what you need to do to be healthy and safe. But anyway, tonight we're going to be talking about doomsday cults. We're really excited to have our guest tonight. Alan Warren is an author. He's written a book called Doomsday Cults, The Devil's Hostages. And he is he's written a bunch of true crime stuff and many, many books on the topics that we're going to talk about tonight. But what is it about people like Charles Manson or Jim Jones or David Koresh? Or some of these other people that gain this group of followers that will do basically anything they tell them to. In some cases, they go to strangers' homes and commit unspeakable acts of murder. In other cases, they'll literally drink the Kool-Aid and commit mass suicide, almost 1,000 people. So what is it about these leaders and these cults that, first of all, attract people, and second of all, make them do things that they wouldn't most likely do in the normal course of their lives? So Alan Warren will be our guest tonight, and we'll be talking about that. Yeah, I know, I need a haircut. I told you, that I had a little bit of beer on Friday night, and this is what happens. I did just see that we've now been extended to this social distancing and basically home lockdown for the entire month of April. I know it's a bit petty to even talk about it, but I can't imagine not being able to do anything for another 30 days. It's just bizarre. But we've got to do it, right? We've got to stop this thing. Anyway, let's go to break and get our guest on with us. Alan Warren, again, will be our guest tonight, and he'll be talking about doomsday cults. He's written about the topic in a new book, and we have a terrific show ahead for you, and we're looking forward to getting it started. It's Beyond Reality. Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Looking forward to kicking off the week with our guest tonight. Alan Warren is joining us. Alan has written a book called Doomsday Cults, The Devil's Hostages. He's also the writer of many true crime books and has had his hand in this for a while. Alan, welcome to Beyond Reality. It's great to have you with us tonight.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
How did you get involved with this? It seems to me almost anywhere you look now, turn on Netflix, Amazon Prime, whatever it happens to be, maybe even cable television, and you see true crime stuff, and people are fascinated by this. How did you get your interest in it?
Oh, mine's a long time going. I mean, when I was a young kid, like 5 and 6, I used to listen to radio all the time, and back then I listened to things like The Shadow and The Whistler and all that. So I was kind of a radio mystery crime kid as it was, and it just grew into it.
It's not difficult to find an interest in this. I'm not exactly sure what part of us finds this stuff fascinating, but almost all of us do. Is there something in human nature that makes us just want to know more about people that do bad things?
There's probably that. There's also the ability for ourselves. Like, you know, I think each one of us has a lot of the characteristics that we find in killers and people that cause, you know, crime. And so I think what happens is sometimes we want to see where we fit in.
And fitting in is a broad term. And some people feel they fit in maybe at the complete opposite of the spectrum. And then some people find some type of appeal in belonging to something that may have a purpose, may not have a purpose, but to them it has a purpose. And they don't look at the, maybe don't look at the bigger picture, or maybe what that purpose does to other people. It's kind of, it becomes a blind allegiance at some point.
Oh, yeah. Like a lot of times people are looking for some sort of peace, right? They're looking for some sort of, I don't know, some sort of structure in their life. And a lot of times people have problems with whatever's going on in the world. And so they look for comfort. And along comes religion or religious groups. And you see in a lot of the mainstream major religions right now, a lot of the younger people in society have kind of turned away from it. They don't necessarily believe in it. And what they do is they look for something else, something that they're closer to. And I think that's why all these cults or new religious movements sort of are attractive.
We have, there are a lot of things that show up in the news that pique our interest as it relates to crime, as it relates to cults, as it relates to just people doing things that you know they wouldn't normally do in what we would consider to be a socially normal life. But that's not what we're talking about here. And let's start at the beginning. Your book is called Doomsday Cults, The Devil's Hostages. Define for us, if you will, what a doomsday cult is.
Well, in general, this is a first of a series of books I'm doing on cults in general. And doomsday cults themselves tend to have some sort of charismatic leader. And what they're doing is they're telling their followers that, you know, the apocalypse is now. The end of the world is happening now. And they generally try to get their followers to believe that they're part of an army, an army that's going to pick up the world after it falls apart and lead it for God. They're going to do the regrowth of human race, so to speak. So most doomsday cults come from that.
So there's a end of an apocalyptic component, and then there's a rebirth component to it.
Yes, almost in almost all of them there is of some sort, and I've included, of course, most of the main religions, but there's also the component of people that do not believe in anything Abrahamic. So they're not Christians or Jews or Islam. They're more into the vampire soul sort of spiritual world, I guess you'd call it.
When we look at the idea of a doomsday cult, have these things existed throughout human history, or are they a relatively new creation?
Well, I think they've always existed. Since I should clarify that, for let's say the last couple of hundred years, I before that, I don't know, you know, when you've got a whole different world landscape back before a couple hundred years ago, and also the way people lived and how they communicated, and it's sort of a different way of being a doomsday cult, but there were some. But they really started to spring up probably 1800s, early 1900s would be the first kind of real have-hold sort of doomsday, this is it.
Are there certain political or societal factors that have to be in place for these things to gain some kind of traction, or can they just appear out of nowhere at any time?
Well, it's funny you say that. I think that it's unique to the political atmosphere at the time, but the cult in itself is still the same. And I mean that in the sense of, if you look in the 60s, most of the people that were, let's say, left, you know, more liberal, were into the, you know, the Summer of Love in 67 and the peace and all that stuff. So most of the people that were attracted to cults were in that side and were definitely left side. You know, like you had Charles Manson and you had Anton LaVey, Church of Satan. You had all these factions opening up, and they were attracting people that were on the liberal point of view. Whereas when you get later into even the 80s and some of the current cults now, you're talking that they tend to be more conservative and more on the right side. So it plays into it, but maybe I should say what it does is it grabs most of the people that are not, or they feel like they're not in power.
When we talk about left side, right side, you know, when you talk about a political philosophy, does that political philosophy guide the cult, or is it kind of just a side factor that you look at as someone who studies these cults?
Well, it kind of guides them in a sense, you see, because right now, for instance, some of the current cults tend to be more, I say they're right, and only on the right side are conservative, because that's who they're attracting and that's who they're looking for. And so the religious right tends to have an influence on how they do their recruiting. So, you know, they're looking for a particular type of person, and they tend to fit more of, see, right now there's a lot of conspiracies, and a lot of conspiratorial on the right side tend to fall into the religious movements. So there's a connection between conspiracies and cults at this time, but it always hasn't been.
And we're going to talk about some of the more notorious cults that we have experienced over the course of the last 40, 50 years. Maybe, actually, it's even longer than that now. Charles Manson, obviously, Jim Jones. But you're referencing some activity that's going on today. And are these cults maybe people that we might also call preppers or some of that stuff?
Well, there's some of that in a way, you see, because in the current times, in the last 5 years especially, we see a lot of, like what you say, preppers, and it's they're not as religious movement based as they are doomsday, and definitely the politics plays into it. You know, they, again, you know, people feel out of control. They feel like their government's not there for them, and they feel like they're being used, and something they're going to do something bad to them, and so their response is with their own movement, like prepping or setting up against bio warfare or whatever. And again, conspiracies come into it. People formulate groups and. I don't know. You see, it's kind of it plays off of each other.
How large can or small can a cult be to define it as a cult, particularly a doomsday cult? And the other part of this question is, can something like what we saw happening in Nazi Germany, can the Nazi movement have been a cult?
Oh, for sure. You know, politics becomes a cult. Like, we are... just as when you say the Nazis and Mussolini was very cult of personality, they become a cult. You know, Donald Trump is sort of emphasizing as well, like there's sort of a movement, even Bernie Sanders to an extent. So politics becomes a cult because it's people, you got to remember there's a lot of, there's a lot of people that are feeling very insecure.
Right.
And this time, just like they did back in the Nazi times, and when, you know, and there's different times in our history where there's so much insecurity and nobody to turn to, or they feel there's nobody to turn to. So as soon as someone comes up and gives them the rally, they jump into it because they feel like they're going, and people get swept up into it. So religion, you know, politics and religion are really kind of crossing that way, you know, because really all it is you've got people that are believing in a philosophy no matter what, and they're going to go step by step with that philosophy no matter how silly it sounds.
So I get my next question was going to be something that you may have just answered for me, but I want to ask it anyway. If we talk about an organized political party, or we talk about an organized religion, how do they, the people that follow either of those two things, or maybe even both in some cases, differ from those who might follow a cult? Is there any difference, or is it just a blind allegiance?
There's very little difference. I think it's what it is you see, you have to say, well, how do we define a cult? Like a lot of people, when you say cult, they think of it as something bad. You know, initially, most people, that's terrible. Cult, bad thing. Mm-hmm. So, but if you put cult on something like Steve Hazan did with his book about the cult of Trump, then you have all the backlash and say, well, that's not a cult, you know, it's because you're putting something bad in front of another name. But all it really is an assembly, a group of people. I mean, when I started writing this book, one of the big things I that was stuck in my mind was Charles Manson. And this is the backlash I get for this book, and because I'm comparing Jesus Christ to Charles Manson, and not as in a negative. What I'm saying is, if you had someone like Jesus Christ today, if you had someone that fit that look, the praised love and all the things that he apparently did a long time ago, how would our society treat someone like that now? Like, how would you treat someone that's healing people, someone that's God's son? Like, if he said all the things that you hear in different cults now, you would think cult. So, but it's not my intention to put down Christianity. That's not what it's about. What I'm saying is, how does society in itself relate to a group, a religious group, and when does it that they decide it's a cult? You know, so that's the cult has become a very a dirty word, so to speak, because people associate it with anything that they disagree with.
Yeah, I mean, because we only tend to hear, you know, the headlines are made by those groups, cults, that do things that are just difficult to believe. You know, Charles Manson is a perfect example. Jim Jones is another perfect example. Those are headlines, and not only the headlines of the day, but then they live on through documentaries and people that revisit them constantly. So those are the cults that we hear about. What are some other, what we would consider to be cults, not let's not talk about politics or religion right now, but other groups that may coexist peacefully that we could point to that say, hey, see, they're not all necessarily going to commit mass suicide or murder?
Well, you see, when you get out of doomsday, you start getting into self-help cults, you know, and just because, again, we associate the word cult as bad.
Right.
But what if it's a cult that does good? A cult that's not killing people. It's almost like a sociopath or a psychopath. What if you have one of those that doesn't kill? Does that mean they're okay? So the end result and how they're acting or performing at the time when you see them doesn't necessarily represent what they are. So again, we like to put them into these cute little things and say, oh, it's a cult. It's no good. I mean, and really, how different is something like Bikram's yoga? Look at how much that turned into a cult, or the people that died in that hot tent, you know, the self-help guru and stuff like, so there's, or the family praises love and the whole thing, but bad things still come out of them.
Did we lose our guest?
I don't know. I'm here.
Oh, there you are. You cut out for a second.
Oh, wow.
You know, the funny thing is that we've been having a lot of data issues. You know, I guess this what's going on in the country and around the world is sucking up some internet usage and bandwidth that might not normally be used, and therefore it's stressing some systems. But either way, you're there. That's good. We're going to go to break in just a minute. But before we do, Alan, you've got a lot of books. We're talking specifically tonight about Doomsday Cults, The Devil's Hostages. But you've written a bunch of stuff. Can you just walk us through a couple of what you would say are your more recommended works? I'm sure they're like children. It's hard to pick a few. However, for our listeners who might be new to your work, in addition to Doomsday Cults, what type of your work would you recommend they start with?
Oh, geez, you know, it depends on the type of reader, but Beyond Suspicion, which is about Colonel Russell Williams, who was the highest ranking Canadian officer and been through the top security. And while he was in charge of transportation of anybody that was of royalty or government from other countries throughout the country. And so he is very high up. Meanwhile, what he was doing was breaking into people's houses and putting on the woman of the house's clothes and taking pictures and with him wearing the clothes. And it just gets really bizarre. Wow. Because after 80-some break-ins, he starts to tie up, go there with the woman that are there, and tie them up.
Oh, wow.
And beat them. And not kill them. And not even rape them. But it does end up in murder. So that's probably, that's still one of my most popular books. And I think it's pretty well written. And of course, The Killing Game, which is about Rodney Alcala. Out in L.A., going around killing people, he was on the dating game show, and he actually won the date for the night.
Wow.
And she said he was so creepy she wouldn't go to the hotel and the dinner with him, even though he won. And so at that same time, he had two dead bodies in his trunk.
Oh wow!
So he is a character. But the books, don't get me wrong, there is the basic idea. I do write about the facts, what happens and everything, but I want people to understand that each one of these that I've chose to write over the years has something to do with the justice system and how it handled that case. So there's always a twist in each one of them, and I just want people to understand I'm not really writing about the gore. There's plenty of those books. I'm really writing about the effect it has on everybody around them and what we do as a justice system. Like Rodney Alcala has been to trial three times on the same five murder charges because he keeps getting sentenced to death in all of them, gets an automatic appeal, and because California won't kill the people, they always overturn the conviction.
Jeez. Oh,
so the families, all the way from 68 up to now, even the six-year-old girl, the first one he attacked, she's still alive and she has to come to trial.
Ugh.
And he defends himself, so he gets to put on a voice and question her as if he's an attorney.
Wow.
He's questioning the people he assaulted, and our system keeps paying for it because he has no money. So that's my point in that book. And the point of all of them, there's always some twist like that. And that's what makes me go for those type of books, because I want people to really understand what goes on.
Was the start of this for you in writing about stories like that? I don't mean stories in a fictional sense, but telling those stories. When you started writing for True Case Files magazine, is that how it started?
Yeah, that was the first job I took. I think the biggest thing is some of the people that know me know that I started late in my life because I was autistic. I still am. and so I came out really late. I wasn't able to write properly and express myself to other people. It took a lot of years and a lot of work, but I made it. So the reason I say that, so I started slow by doing like articles for True Crime Case Files, or I did Serial Killer Magazine, and I did all sorts of little quick articles, and then I started doing small series of books, part of a bigger, you know, like a whole 26-book series, and I would do four of them, for instance. And so that sort of all kind of came out, and then eventually I worked myself up to being able to write a full book.
Well, congratulations and good for you for overcoming those obstacles. And I'm sure that serves as a bit of an inspiration to others that that suffer as well. So, and I know that you do some advocacy work for autism too. So thank you for doing that and thank you for your hard work.
Oh, yeah, of course. I want people to realize that, I was told when I was young I would never be able to do anything like I'm doing now. And I've been on the radio for years, and I've written books, and I've done all this. I'm getting close to 60, so it took my whole life to get there, but it can be done.
A very, very interesting conversation underway with our guest, Alan Warren. Again, his website is alanrwarren.com. Alan, I know that's your personal website. Your books are all there. You also have houseofmysteryradio.com. What's that one about?
Oh, that's kind of a... I'm on the radio. I do 5 days a week and on NBC KCAA in Los Angeles, and that's at 9 p.m. Pacific, and it's a one-hour show. And I talk to people involved in crime, and it can be people that are lawyers, or it could be a police officer, right through to an author or a movie creator. So, and we talk about how they get into it and what attracts them to it and how they do their work. So that's what that is. And that's, and the site just kind of gives you a lot of the old shows. We put them up there now. So now the new day of podcast, you know.
Yeah, I opened the show talking a little bit about true crime and our fascination with it. I've seen on Netflix things like Making a Murderer, The Staircase, I'm trying to remember, the trial of Gabriel Hernandez. I can't remember exactly, but these true crime miniseries or mini documentaries are popping up all over the place. Do you think these are helping draw attention to some of what's going on in society? Do you think it's an exploitation that we could do without?
Combination of both. Mm-hmm. I think it's getting out of hand, right?
Yeah.
But you know, that's what happens. You know, too many people take it as a business and turn it into that. And it's not necessarily there for the right reason. So, and it's unfortunate. But, you know, you probably saw that in the paranormal world, you know, in the last 10 years before. it was kind of more underground, and it was sort of being done the way I think it should have been. And then it just exploded, and I think it gets out of control.
Yeah, right? Yeah. You know? Absolutely no question about that. And for example, when I really enjoyed Making a Murderer, and then after I watched that 10-part documentary series, I went and actually did a little bit of research on the case, and I realized that the documentarians left a lot of information out of it that would have probably altered the way you perceived what was going on there.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, you know, and I'm not blaming them. Actually, I've met them and talked to them about it, and I don't blame them for it, but they sort of played one side.
Right.
And it's not just totally their fault, because you know, the prosecutor and that wanted no part of it. So they didn't share anything on their side. So it was kind of a combination of the both, which that was unfortunate, because it would have been a better showing. But you see, and that's where we get into this conspiracy, and we start getting into, you know, cults again, because look at how many people think they know what really happened, you know, and they have all these ideas and theories. And I think that's all great, but most of them have never left their house. They haven't been there. I think the biggest problem with true crime right now is all of the crime things, shows and podcasts and things out there that do it all from their house and do it all from the internet.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. There's a big difference, you know, when you talk to someone that's been in the field, and you talk to someone that was actually at the trial and was actually, or is a victim of the family. When you go do research of a book and you talk to all angles, it's so important. It makes such a difference from what you just see on the news or just see in a paper or go online. And then you can't, plus you can't really challenge a lot of your sources online. So I think there's a lot of things being missed, and people are quick to judge. And sometimes you get to the inside of a story, and then you realize, oh, boy, I wonder why that, you know, because that Making a Murderer is a perfect example, because I would have, after seeing it, I was more on the side of, yeah, these guys probably didn't do it, it's innocent, they got railroaded.
Yeah.
But when you start seeing the real stuff, what went on in the trial, and all the things that wasn't shown in there, plus the documentarians, as they call it, actually clipped out parts of it so that you wouldn't see it. They actually covered up things. So if you're looking at things from a totally non-biased point of view, just fact, you'd be like, wow, you know, this isn't what we think it is.
I think we have to go into those programs remembering, just like we did in the paranormal world, in many cases you have to remember it's entertainment. This is TV, folks. This is not actually a trial unfolding in front of you. This is TV.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because, you know, after I got into the business and I was in actually going out and doing books and stuff, research, and then you come back and shows things that I used to like the old, back, you know, in the 80s, you know, American Crime, you know, the different ones on A&E of the old days. And I thought, wow, these are great shows. And then you watch them now and you realize they were doing the same thing. You know, it's just like Dateline stuff. I mean, it's all great. I know a lot of these people that do them, and it's all good. But they are telling a story, and they're telling it in one way. But you do need more than one side of a story to get a full picture of what happened, because it's just like your own personal life. You know, if I talk to a couple of people that really dislike you and a couple of people that totally love you, I'm going to get two totally different stories,
right,
about who you are. And they're probably both true from their own points of view. So if I choose one that dislikes you, I can make you sound like a terrible person. And then if you're up for some sort of crime, people watching what I do will say, yeah, he's a terrible man.
Right.
He did it. You know, and that's kind of the problem. And that's the unfortunate. And again, it gets into cults and conspiracies, because you hear one side or you see one piece on something, and you just sort of take it that way, you know, and you kind of go, yeah, you know, but the thing is, there's more to it. You can't just jump on it. And people love to hate right now. So,
yeah, it's true. When we start talking about cults and doomsday cults in particular, as it relates to your book, you know, we look at leaders like Charles Manson, his name keeps coming up for obvious reasons, Jim Jones, another one. What is the common denominator with people like that? Is it all charisma? Is that what the fuel is that allows them to end up where they end up with these people?
Well, that's a really good attraction for people. You know, like with both Jim Jones and Charles Manson, they both had the way of, and when you talk to people that were involved with them, like Diane Lake, Snake, you know, who was involved with Manson, you know, they tell you how he just focused in on you. He looked at you eyes to eyes. He told you how beautiful you were, and everything you say and do is wonderful, and you are love, and you're, you know, and he give them, like they would tell me 100%. There was no distraction. That this leader was focused on them. Everything they, you know, that they were just ultimate people. So it made them feel good. And you got to remember, like in each case, like I said, they sort of have a type of a character that they're looking for. In Manson's case, he loved the younger girls, like 14, 15, 16, that were runaways, that had, you know, they had no place to go. They didn't feel loved for whatever reason. And so he was there telling them how beautiful they were and how, you know, and everything so that's really the way of getting someone in. And even Jim Jones was like adopting black children and preaching love, and we're all the same and commune. You know, he was the first major sort of religious movement that took in gays and took in minorities without even blinking the eye. You know, he opened up. He would, and this is going to sound a little bit, I'm not trying to be, you know, it's insensitive, but he would actually embrace, this is the time, you know, in the 60s and the 70s when you have the race riots going on, and to be gay is still illegal. You can go to jail for it. And he would embrace them and touch them, and, you know, kind of like the old Princess Di would touch common people. It was just a shock. And so he had this way of connecting, and that's really how you draw people in. And that's the unfortunate thing, because then you get indoctrinated, you know. In those cases, you know, you give up everything you own. You know, if you have a house, car, money, it all goes to the group, and you end up living in a commune, and so you become more trapped.
I'm going to admit that I'm probably a little less educated in some of this stuff than I would like to be. However, with Charles Manson, you mentioned runaways, obviously a natural place for someone who is trying to escape something from home. There's a giant hole in their lives. It seems like it would be rather, not necessarily easy, but certainly easier for someone like Charles Manson to fill that void and create a follower. But it wasn't just runaways that he was attracting either, was it?
No, he would get more than that, but that was an easy, like, one of the biggest things, and I point this out in this book, that people don't realize that in the 60s, when he was in jail and he got out for just small offenses and he was hanging in San Francisco, he was right across the street from a Haight-Ashbury free clinic. And he was there every day because so many of his girls and girlfriends had to get treated for sexual, you know, STDs and stuff. Right. And it was all free. And so he met a lot of people there. This is the same clinic that was giving, LSD to people that were alcoholics, because it was an experimental drug back then. So they considered it to be something that was helping people to recover from alcoholism, you know, which is silly when you look back at it. But at the time, they thought it was good. And there's a big, actually a conspiracy, but I can see why, because one of the doctors there actually worked on the MKUltra program. And so there's a thing of, like, this is where Charles Manson learned how influential LSD was on his followers. So if he had someone that challenged him and that he felt was really a threat to him in a sense, and even men that did that, he would get them, he would get with them and get them on LSD. Then he would tell them a story, and he realized how he could turn them. And that's all true information. There's the conspiracy of people saying, well, you know, they were using him, or he was trained by the CIA to do this and all that. I sort of don't really see that, and I don't see any evidence, but he certainly did use LSD as one of his tools, and he realized how much influence he could have over people by using it.
When we look at Charles Manson's following, and it's one thing to give people a place where they can feel loved, welcomed, and have a bed and maybe some food, whatever it happens to be, to fill some voids. It's another thing to create such blind devotion that you can tell a few of these members to go into a stranger's home and commit unbelievably savage acts of murder. How does that process evolve?
Well, that's pretty complicated, but I'll tell you in a basic description, they get so involved and so enamored. The biggest thing is there's a point where the first big changeover for one of the followers is when they start to believe that who their leader is, whether it's Charles Manson or Jim Jones or, you know, the Heaven's Gate guy or David Koresh, they believe that they are either the prophet or the son of God or some religious person. And so they believe they're acting on their God's will. They're doing what they're told to do by God. And it's not really any different than someone that's into Islam or into Christianity or any religion. Once they become so devoted to that person, then nothing's out of bounds, out of reach. It's just it becomes natural. And that's a normal progression in this. If they stay in long enough, that's all that matters is their their prophet, their leader, their whatever you want to call them.
And some of those followers remained loyal to Charles Manson right up until his death, didn't they not?
Yeah, you know, and that's another point, you know, because then it gets to so that person starts to follow them no matter what, and you know, it doesn't matter if Charles Manson steal cars and drugs and then start killing people. It's, you know, he's God, he's everything. It's we're supposed to do this. It's written, you know. And then there's to a point where they get so indoctrinated that even if Charles Manson is proven to be someone bad, or the leader, whoever it is proven that they're terrible, it doesn't matter, because they, you know, interesting when they talk about the Branch Davidians and people I talk to that are still part of the Davidians, even after all said and done. Yeah. And they're actually waiting for David Koresh to return to the earth because they think he's God.
Wow.
I mean, so, you know, even when I was on Coast to Coast there in March, and we had call in. And even Richard Serrett asked him, he said, well, do you believe that, you know, David Koresh is coming back? And he's like, oh, yeah, I don't want to answer that. You know, it's and people I talk to, they believe that he sacrificed his life like Jesus in the same sort of, you know, thing, and he's coming back. And they're waiting for him to come back. There's still people right now, and that's with all of these. So, you know, it becomes that's the next step is when they not only do they follow everything the leader says, but even after the leader's dead and gone or something's passed, they still follow what the teachings were. So they get even further indoctrinated than what the original cult leader wanted them to be. It's just it's almost crazy, but.
Yet we see it, and it happens. I wouldn't say it happens every day, but it certainly happens enough that you have to look at society and wonder how this is a byproduct of it. Before we move on from Charles Manson, the pop culture component of what Manson did, especially coming out of a very turbulent time in American history, that seems to have longevity that many of these others don't. What's unique about this one?
I think more because of how many movements were happening at the time. You know, when you look at what was going on in the 60s and the revolution, so to speak, the revolution was on the left, and it was all about rights and love and peace and all that sort of stuff. I think just as the Church of Satan came out the same thing in the 60s in the same area, I think there's a real attraction. And it just stays with us because Charles Manson was an amazing character to be able to play people, and even the world, even the way he played to the press, even when he did interviews, he scared people just watching him on television. You know, it's almost like what you create, the image you create, the Wizard of Oz. You know, the all great wizard, and everybody's. Everybody's on edge around that person, and I think he just sort of had that way. And the unfortunate thing is young people are always sort of each generation that comes up tends to be more, I don't know, more open to that sort of suggestion. Because at that time, you have nothing. And you know, when you were young and you looked at the older people in your lives, you thought a lot of things they did were crazy. You know, the structure and right. The jobs and everything. You know what I mean? And it keeps on going on. That doesn't going to change. And so they're open to something different. And so, you know, the music is different for each generation. And then, you know, but it's not really. It's just, you know, it's just one of those things. And he's attractive to young people.
I want to try to make a comparison here. And forgive me if my language doesn't do this justice. But from what I know of Charles Manson, obviously most of these cult leaders that we're talking about were in some fashion madmen. Charles Manson was particularly, I'm not sure how to even put this. Was there a mental illness component with Charles Manson? And I want to compare it to what I know about Jim Jones, who really seemed to descend into some mental illness toward the end of his life.
Yeah, they had different directions. They both started out with the same sort of peace, love, and communal idea, and we're all the same, and kumbaya and that stuff, right? So that's
right,
all there.
Right.
But Jim Jones had a real paranoia and a real fear from even when he was in Indiana, and he adopted his first black child. You know, and this back then, there were stores that wouldn't serve him because of that. His wife couldn't get groceries at certain stores. That's how bad it was. See, people don't realize what the world was like in the 60s.
Yeah.
And things like that happened. And he had threats on his life, and he had people burning his property. So he got really on edge. He started hiring bodyguards, and that was all before the whole San Francisco thing. So so when you have that element, and then he started using drugs on top of it. So you have the element of someone that's paranoid, using drugs, has bodyguards, has people threatening him. Then he becomes huge, blows up in California, and becomes like this rock star, you know, the president's wife's meeting with him. Like, he's getting all these things now. Right. So the combination of that, I think, makes someone feel invincible. And so they start demanding what they want. And, you know, the change starts to, you know, starts to happen, and they start losing control. They start believing in what they say. And Charles Manson didn't have that same direction. He had the same start. But I think it's an interesting thought. I think Charles Manson felt very degraded. He was very, you know, he got in with the Beach Boys and that whole thing, and Terry Melcher and all that. And he never got the rock star that he wanted. And I think he was slighted. And I think it was revenge. I think he turned this into a personal revenge. You know, the whole thing about the Beatles and the White Album and all that sort of stuff, and all the different things that he put together, Helter Skelter and stuff, that was just part of his cult work. But I don't think he necessarily believed a lot of that stuff. And even the prosecutor at the time didn't. But it was something to sell to the jury,
right?
Because he had to put him away. But there's so much more to that story. It's not, you know, it's not a coincidence that, you know, the La Biancas were right beside the house of where he was going to get even with a drug dealer that screwed him out of some money, and they'd already moved. And it's not a coincidence, you know, Terry Melcher lived in where Sharon Tate was, and then he just moved out and she moved in.
Right.
I mean, I don't believe that they're accidents. He was going there with an intention of revenge, and, you know, again, drugs, and he was a little off and whatever else, and things just happen. And, you know, and plus he wasn't there, you know, he would tell them what to do. So there's so much more to that in the Manson case than there is in, let's say, Jim Jones. Because Jim Jones was following we're going to be a communist group all the way to the end, even in Guyana, and he even wanted to send all of his money to Russia, and
yeah.
So he didn't change that. He just became very insulated and insecure and had to have his own bodyguards. And when it started losing control, it's like, well, it's the old, I'm going to kill everyone.
And I want to go through the Jim Jones story. I find this one to be, as they all are, rather fascinating. But the fact that it can end with nearly 1,000 people committing suicide on the orders of one person is pretty remarkable. Alan, walk us through how this path started and Jim Jones ultimately gave that directive on that day, which, if you remember the pictures, is just a sea of people in color. That's the thing that stands out to me when you see pictures of that scene. It's just people lying on the ground with colorful clothes, and there's nearly 1,000 of them there. How can this happen?
Yeah, that was and it's crazy because I included this. You're right. There's a lot of people that don't know Jim Jones or didn't know what happened. I was surprised even when I was doing a signing, and it seemed like everybody that's in their 20s goes, well, who's Jim Jones?
Right.
It's like, wow, you know, so it's, but that was 1978, so time flies. But Jim Jones started in Indiana, and his father was a Pentecostal preacher, and he was really into that, speaking in tongues and all that, and he just loved it. He was very curious about it, and he was very curious about death. You know, he used to go out in the woods and set up a little stand, and he would preach to nobody. He would just be preaching in the woods, and people had caught him. He had also been doing funerals for different animals that have died and stuff. So he was just enamored with that whole lifestyle, and eventually he became a minister or a priest, and then he started his People's Temple, and it changed, you know, entities a few times. And now, this is kind of the where something was just kind of a little bit crazy. He thought he was able to fly as a kid. He thought he had the power, And so he jumped off his roof and ended up just breaking some bones and stuff. But he had this this thing that he thought he was here because of God, and he had some sort of special power. And that's sort of where it all began. And he also thought that the world was going to end and that they were going to be dropping bombs on the United States. And so that was the reason he moved to California, because he wanted to go to a place where they would be safe. And so off to California he went, and he became a very popular social minister of the People's Temple. He had Jane Fonda. He had all sorts of stars and politicians that were going to his church and talking about him, and he became very popular, and in fact, so popular in San Francisco, I think he had like 16,000 followers that could go around. He would bus them around and vote in whoever he wanted. So the mayor and quite a few people on council were very, very, you know, rubbing elbows with him. He became very popular, and that's kind of where his highlight was. But again, with his paranoia and his fear and his drug use, he wanted to get out of the country. And there was some newspaper articles and some magazines that were starting to have people that had left the temple and sort of said bad things about him. And he was starting to feel a little bit shaky and paranoid, so he went down to Guyana. And now, the reason he chose that country was because it was the only English-speaking communist country that also didn't have any extradition with the U.S. So he felt like he would be out of the control of America.
Right.
And so he found a good location, started Jonestown, brought in a couple hundred people. They started building it, and eventually he had 1,000 people there, and they were supposed to be living well and happy, and everything was good. But there was a few couples that were followers of his, and they had broke up, and in two cases, both the mothers stayed back in the U.S., and the father went to Jonestown and brought their children. And so the mothers in both cases decided to they wanted their children back, but the U.S. didn't have any, you know, sort of working relationship, so they weren't able to do it. But that caused a big rift, and so then the U.S. One of the San Mateo congressmen and a team of reporters decided to go and check out Jonestown and check out the kids and see if everybody was okay, and see if any of those stories were true that was kind of going around. And so that's when they flew there and check out the temple, and it looked really good the first day, but I guess on the second day they started getting some letters, secret notes from people that were in there saying that they wanted to get out and to go back to the U.S. And so that was kind of the beginning of the end, because once that was brought to Jim Jones' attention by one of the reporters, he decided that he had to stop this. So he actually had the senator, a few reporters, and quite a few different followers that were trying to leave. They were all shot at the airport, and there was a few of them that survived it. And back in the temple itself, he told them all to that they had to commit a revolutionary suicide. And so he gave them a Flavor Aid, which was like a Kool-Aid. It was an off-brand, and poisoned them. And the people that wouldn't drink it, he had them shot. And so there ended up being 912 bodies that were eventually discovered at the time. And so that's kind of the base of the story. He himself, there's different stories. He either shot himself or had someone shoot him. I've heard from different people, and one of the survivors even, and I don't know, I think he shot himself, but I don't know which is, I don't know if we have exact proof on that.
I think there were about a half a dozen people that survived it, and I've seen a few documentaries where they discuss the ordeal. It is an unbelievable thing. And the fact...
The worst thing is, like, the people, there's two that I talked to, and one I even did in an interview on the radio, and the thing is, you know, when they come back to the States, they were shunned. They had a terrible return, and they ended up on the street doing drugs, prostitution, had a terrible, terrible, a big part of their life coming back from that, because they were so... They were like the scarlet letter, you know, nobody wanted anything to do with them. And there's the old, and we see this today, you know, someone that's been in a cult and they come out of it, others treat them really badly, you know. Oh, you know, they think they never get close to you because they think there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
So people get discarded. And it was a really bad situation for the people that did return.
You know, prior to the mass suicide, which I think you can argue whether it was a suicide or a murder, and it was a little of both, maybe. Obviously, there was an element of fear among the people who were members, particularly those who were trying to get out of there, or they wouldn't have felt the need to secretly slip notes to the U.S. politician. They would have just said openly, we want to leave. And they couldn't, could they?
No. Yeah, there's no way, you know. And where they were located in Guyana... There it was a long way to the closest town, and they were set up, and they were all, it was just a really, I think people don't realize how isolated they become when they join these groups. And so, you know, there was a certain amount of isolation in California when they were in their commune, but not as much as when they take you away. And that's kind of the direction that these cult leaders will take their followers. You know, it's where it's an open come and go, no problem, to all of a sudden a commune, and then a commune outside of the country, and they had no way of getting back. And in fact, when the people went to Guyana, they had to surrender all their documents, right? So they had no ID, they had nothing, and they had no money, they had no phones, they had nothing. So all of a sudden you're in a commune and you're told to work, and you work 7 days a week. I hear the hours were hard. They ate nothing but rice, it was a slave sort of labor. These people were building this thing for Jim Jones and really getting nothing out of it. And I think that some people didn't take to that, of course, and they wanted to leave. They wanted their freedom, and they couldn't get out.
Some people say, and I can't remember if this was the prevailing theory, that Jones used to have these, dry runs, practice runs of this quote-unquote suicide, where there was obviously no poison in the drink, and that many at that time thought that this was just another one of those practice runs, not realizing that the poison had actually been put into the drink. Do we know if that's true?
Yeah, no, and it's true and it's not true. What happened was he used to do those dry runs. They weren't really. What they were was... He was testing the loyalty of people, so he didn't do it with all of his followers. He would have a group of people of his followers in a room, serve them wine, and then after everybody drank the wine and talked, he would tell everybody they would be dead in 45 minutes, that this was God's wish. And so he wanted to see the reaction of his followers, and he always chose people for a particular reason. So it was more of a test. When you get to Jonestown, no, that was not what happened. Jonestown, there's all the recordings. He was speaking over the loudspeaker. He was taking his meth, and he was getting higher and higher and telling everybody that they're revolutionary suicide and we have to do this. And this is, so everybody knew this was the end. They just did, you know, but the thing is, he told his followers there that they wouldn't feel a thing. They would drink this, and everybody, you're just going to fall asleep, and then you'll wake up in heaven, right? You know, that sort of thing. And so a lot believed him, and some didn't. The problem, what the reaction was he told the parents, have your kids drink first.
Yeah.
And so what happened was they were giving their kids this Flavor Aid, and then their kids would go into convulsions and foaming and twitching and go in terrible pain. And that scared the parents because they believed that it was just like, you drink this, you go to sleep, and, you know, and we'll wake up in heaven type thing. So that's when some of them would scream and say no, and then so he had them shot. And some of them, he forced them to drink it. So that's why you see a lot of the parents that were shot and killed laying on top of the kids. Even when they first flew over, they thought they were estimating 200 dead. And then when they got down on the ground and they started lifting the bodies, they would see that they're 3 and 4 high because the kids were laying below them that had died earlier. So they had no idea that it ended up being over 900. So no, right from the get-go, right after he shot Senator or Congressman Ryan and the team, he was announcing, this is it. We're, you know, this is about love and, you know, don't, you know, that stuff, and don't be scared and stuff like that. So, no, they all knew.
Before I ask the next question, there have been many, I guess you would call them either documentaries or biopics on the Jonestown Massacre. Is there one that you particularly think stays true to the story that you would recommend people to watch?
I'll tell you, the best book on that in detail would be Jeff Gwynn's book. Nobody touches it. Mm-hmm. Nobody comes close. And he was in one documentary for, I believe it's Sundance, and nobody touches that. He was down there. He's probably one of the best investigative journalists I've ever come across in my life. And, he's written a couple of books like that, and his one on the Jonestown and that documentary, that nothing comes close. He has details, and he tells you the way it really was. You can hear he has all the evidence, and he goes from Jones' childhood in detail right up until the end. And because too many other books with the Jonestown in particular have too many conspiracies,
yeah,
you know, and it throws it. You know, I've heard, you know, God, there's all that stuff about, you know, he was a communist, which he had communist ideas, but they had this idea that him and Harvey Milk and it was a conspiracy and all. It's just when you start getting to that, it gets crazy, you know.
Obviously, one of the results of that horrific event was the phrase "drink the Kool-Aid," which is commonly used now to mean blind devotion to something. But apart from that, when we look at Manson's cult and the things he did, the horrific things he did, and we look at Jonestown, we look at others, have we learned anything from any of this as a society? Can we learn anything from any of this?
Well, I mean, I would hope that we do, and I think that in a small percentage we do, but it's like anything else. We, you know, the new generation comes along. The world changes every single day because there's a whole pile of new lives, and there's people that have passed, and so it just changes every single day. It's and if you've been alive long enough to know, we have the same things that we go through over and over again, and we can't learn the lesson because up comes the next generation that has never heard of it. You know, they don't know it. But I think in science-wise, we do learn a lot of why people do what they do. And I think overall it is getting better, but we still have a long way to go in the human race.
I had somebody on the program, and I'm sorry, I just don't remember the gentleman's name. He's written a book about his experience with the Seven Tribes and was explaining that he felt very similar to maybe some of the people that were in the Jonestown situation, where they were trapped and they wanted to get out, and it was almost impossible to get out. There are some similar things going on all around us as we sit here today.
Oh, it's constant. It's constant. It's the old thing. Just the names change, but it's the same. It's the same scenario, and it's over and over. And it happens. This is something going on in every country. You know, I put in here about Japan and Canada and Switzerland and France. And this is kind of a, you know, we have too many people that are looking for something that feel very lost. And again, they need the comfort, and it's just there. I don't know how we're ever going to go over it.
What happens in a situation like we're facing today? We are in unprecedented territory here with these lockdowns, these self-quarantine, social distancing, whatever they're calling them now. And we're just told that, for the most part, we won't be able to leave our homes for another 6 weeks. Does this type of thing fuel maybe cult activity, maybe doomsday cult activity? Obviously, there are people that think this is the end of the world.
Oh, yeah. You know, and that's constant, and they're always looking for it. This is the millennials 9/11. You know, this is their challenge, and you know, it's all of our challenge. But it's something that will stick with them, and when they have children, they will bring them up with this in their mind. You know, just as each generation has something, it was our World War II, right? For someone that's older, you know, the thing is these terrible things that happen scare us. And in the U.S. in particular, people are on edge and more scared than they are anywhere else in the world. And that's a whole other show. But there's a lot of people, and they do things out of fear, right? Like when you look at all the things that go around social media about, you know, this coronavirus and COVID-19, and it's germ warfare, and now you've got Alex Jones out there saying that the bubble wrap, you know, that the Chinese planted it in. So when every time you order from Amazon,
oh, wow,
and you open up your package, that bubble wrap is all made in China, and they planted the coronavirus in that. And it's like, well, you know, the thing is, people believe that, and they buy it with no evidence. It's just a theory. And they're scared already. And when people are scared, and also, you know, in this particular case, too, it's just like a war where everything changes. You lose your social life. You lose your job. A lot of people lose their homes.
Yeah.
And then they go to war, so to speak. And in this particular case, the people that are at war are the medical and the people on the front lines there. So back in World War II, all the men went to war across the ocean, and the ladies had to go in and build ammunition, and you know, but it, you know, you had ration sugar and ration. It's just this tragedy. I don't think it's the end of the world. I really don't. I think it's changing. I think that these viruses are going to become more frequent, and we as a society are going to have to learn how to live around it, live through it, and to live differently in order to move forward. And it's hard because North America spoiled.
I mean, yeah.
Just face it. I mean, we want our latte at Starbucks, and we want our, you know, I mean, it's easy to get into it. I mean, I love, there's some great things we have in life. And I think that I hope that in general, people realize how much we really do have and start being more positive with each other. Then the negativity is just brutal. And so we need to move forward and start thinking about, well, look at how much good we have, and let's build off the good and just, you know. But things like this will force people to realize how much we can lose and how quickly we can lose it.
The book is called Doomsday Cults, The Devil's Hostages. Alan, what do you want people to walk away with after they read it? How do you want them to, what messages do you want them to walk away with?
The biggest thing in this particular book was to not judge someone right away. Like we're so quick to, you know, in true crime and cults and in politicians and to people, just to flip through, to see a picture of someone on social media or saying something or doing something, and so we hate them. You know, this is, that person's awful. They're this or that, and then the story's and all that. I want people to realize that it happens in these groups as well. We isolate people, and we put them in a category, and we shun them. And then all of a sudden there's separation, and there's too much of that going on. It doesn't matter in what category. And I want people to realize, because that's why I included so many groups. And I kind of give briefings because I'm talking about how people get into it and how they get out of it. We're talking about escaping a cult. We're talking about indoctrination, recruitment, brainwashing, methods. So it's great detail about it. And so it's not just all gore and bad stuff. It's kind of an overview and how we get through it. And if we know someone that's involved or in something, maybe it kind of help us work through it.
And I mentioned the website a couple of times. Is that the best place to find the book if they want to buy?
Oh yeah, and it's in most big bookstores. It's a published book from a publisher, and it's in most like Barnes and Nobles and a lot of independents, and of course Amazon. And but you got to be careful because they might have some Chinese bubble wrap, so you don't.
I was going to say it if you didn't.
So be careful on that. And then, of course, off the website itself, and it's Alan R. Warren. The reason there's an R in there, it's not that I'm, you know, snotty. It's just that there's an Alan Warren that has been writing books, and he's a foot doctor, and he's been doing this for years. And so if you go to just Alan Warren, you'll get foot books.
Well, it's funny you say that because I go by JV professionally because my name is James Johnson, and it doesn't get much more common than that. So.
No. Yeah, it's that one.
Sometimes a curse. Anyway, Alan, fantastic topic, great conversation. Thank you so much for your time. Keep us informed as to what you've got coming up, your other work, because you do such great work, and we'd like to keep tabs on it and have you back on at some point.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by J.V. Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Joha Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.